House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:25 on Friday, or on Monday, March 24th. President, we have Representative Herron, Representative Rainbow, Representative Josephson, Representative Sadler, myself, Chair Olson, and I believe we have Representative Chenault coming in shortly. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. And today we have three bills on the calendar. The first up is House Bill 230, Ada Bonds. And where's Paul?
Louis.
Louis, you good? Come on up, Louis. We first heard this bill on February 21st and then again on March 14th. During the last hearing, we adopted five amendments, including one conceptual amendment. The CS before the committee is version N and incorporates these amendments. Public testimony is still open on the bill. An additional amendment to House Bill 230 was delivered to my office this afternoon. We are holding the amendment. Well, actually, the amendment is out, but we're not taking any action on the amendment today because we received it less than 24 hours before the meeting. And with that, Louis, you want to give us a 30,000-foot brief summary on what the bill does?
Yes, this is my name is Louis Flora. For the record, I'm staff to Representative Paul Seaton. The bill before you is House Bill 230, which would allow the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to issue bonds for an oil and gas processing facility on the North Slope, and it would also create an oil and gas processing facility infrastructure fund to allow the legislature to allocate funding to that specifically. Should I speak to the, I guess the amendment's not before you yet?
Nope.
So, and then there's a number of specific findings on the bill that discuss the difficulty of some of the smaller operations on the slope to access the processing facilities on the slope at this time. And so the intent of this is to increase oil throughput in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And that about sums it up. I can go through specific parts of the bill, but committee had discussed it.
We've had it a couple times. It was more for the people in the room. But,
okay.
And I'd entertain a motion to adopt version N as the working document.
Charleston, I move committee substitute House Bill 230 version N as the working document.
And I'll object. And for purposes of discussion, are there any questions for Louis before we start taking the final public testimony? Representative Sadler, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Brief comment, suggestion, Louis, not a question. On page 2, line 4, I would suggest they invert the words for and allow. So it reads, would allow for new production.
Always nice to have you on.
Can't help.
That's great. No, thanks.
Duly noted through the chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Flora, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Just generally, who do you perceive, or does Representative Seaton perceive, is sort of the target or beneficiary of the bill? I would say beneficiary in not any legal way, but who might this bill benefit?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, the bill is intended, it's the law of general application, so it would benefit any. It's not targeting any specific entity. It would allow anyone that approached ADA to go forward and have that discussion with them on project financing. We in the findings language, you'll notice we talked about some of the access issues that some of the, in finding number 6 on page 2, line 8, we said removing the limit on bonding authority for processing facilities and other infrastructure would allow small companies that do not have capital to finance oil and gas processing facilities to move more oil from new fields. Okay. And that's essentially what the intent is, trying to reach out and expand that reach.
Okay. May I follow up?
Yeah.
Have you talked to the Department of Revenue about what it foresees would be the maximum credits issued and revenue foregone?
through the chair, Representative Josephson, that would be a question I'm not capable of answering, but if there may be a
I believe we have two people from Revenue Online that we can get to in a few minutes.
Online.
Okay. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. This may be for the department instead of you, but it just seems like to me that if there was a project, a good project out there, that there would be private funding. I'm just not sure why we'd need to bond. So I'm not sure if you can answer that or Department of Revenue.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, this has been offered as a concept in the past. It was adopted in a version of Senate Bill 21, and it was just part of a broad package of trying to put everything out there we can do to increase throughput in the pipeline. And this was just another piece of the puzzle that Representative Seaton had been working on in order just to put everything out there in a great range of incentives.
It's not drilling for more oil, so that's the only way to get really truly more throughput. So I guess.
Well, I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Chenault, who came in with the question. Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just as a comment, not necessarily a question, but just as a comment to Representative Reinbold's concern about throughput. Throughput could be increased in the pipeline without drilling any new wells. The problem that we have right now currently is constriction of the process facility that was designed to take more crude than water and gas. And today's gas wells or oil wells now are putting out more water and more gas than they are crude oil. And so the production facility is limited by how much throughput can go through that in each of those categories. The wells today are producing more water and gas, and that limits the amount of oil production actually, because they may have a well that puts out 1,000 barrels of water, oil, and gas a day, and it makes more sense to run that through than it does the five other wells that they have sitting off to the side, because they only run maybe 300 barrels a day of oil, and the rest is all water and gas. So there's ways that they could configure it to make it work better, but it's very expensive. And so, I mean, we could conceivably increase throughput, not a lot, I don't think, but we could just by expanding the production facility or giving other people opportunities. And I think that's what Representative Seaton's bill would be to the possibility of building another production facility to allow others to input their oil wells through there.
Yeah, we've got a couple questions that were related to the Department of Revenue, and we do have Matt Ponder and Robin Wilson online. And Representative Josephson, if you'd like to rephrase your questions for Revenue.
Thank you. Yeah, this is Representative Josephson here in Juneau, and I just want to know generally, I know that the bill calls for, I think, $200 million increase in the ADA allowance. Or maximum bond capacity, if my memory is right. But does Revenue have an idea of the maximum dollar value of credit that may issue under this bill?
Matt or Robin, are you online?
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Matt Fonder. I am the director of the tax division. And Representative Josephson, we don't really have a good handle on that. It's hard to tell how many taxpayers may take advantage of this credit. I think it's important to note that the taxpayer would have to invest a significant amount of money to utilize the credit. I mean, the credit is the lesser of 10% or $10 million, so the taxpayer would have 90% skin in the game, so to speak. So it would obviously be a help, but it's not as much of an encouragement to move forward with the project. I don't think it would be the deal breaker, I guess. So it's really hard to tell how many may or may not take advantage of the credit.
Further question or follow-up?
Well, yes, Mr. Bonder, this has sort of been discussed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What new facilities would you predict would be built with this data bonding?
Through the chair, Representative Justison, I guess I really don't know. I think your crystal ball is probably just as good as mine. I think it's really, really hard to tell.
Okay. Going for the committee's enlightenment, we do have Ted Leonard and Jim Hemsath from ADA online, too, if there are any questions for ADA from the committee. Yeah. Representative Chenault.
Mr. Chairman, if Ted's there, Ted, have there been any companies that have come to you asking for this type of enhancement for a project that they're currently working on?
Through the chair to Speaker Chenault, yes, we are in the process of right now in working with a corporation called Brooks Range that is looking to finance a production facility in order to develop their Mustang oil field.
Oh, Ted, could you read yourself onto the record, please?
Oh, excuse me, Chair. This is, for the record, this is Ted Leonard, Executive Director of ADA.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. Most of us recognized your voice, but any further questions for ADA? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, to the Chair. Ted, could you give us just a general assessment of the impact of an additional $200 million of lending authority? Is that going to affect your interest rates or ability to finance other projects? Is it going to affect the state's bond rating? Just, is this going to stand alone in isolation, or does it have ripple effects?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, ADA believes that this financing will not affect its capacity for financing other projects, or should not affect our rating. These bonds would be ADA bonds, and either could be general obligation bonds of ADA or revenue bonds, and it will not or should not affect the state's rating at all, since they would be funded either by the revenue generated from the project or would be supported by ADA's assets. None of the state's assets would be pledged for this project or for a project under this bond authorization.
Okay. And just in a follow-up, sir. We heard in discussions about the possible RNG transmission line that of the state of Alaska's general debt-to-equity ratio and how much of the general fund, unrestricted general fund, 8%, I think, that they would allow as a principal to be lent out. That was awkward. The question, I guess, is there a informal policy or rule of thumb that ADA has for what it cannot exceed and how much it can lend out? I guess it's a general bond, general obligation bond question.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, yes, we have a rule of thumb right now under our capacity model that we have a capacity of approximately $500 million of lending authority or bonding authority or, bonding capacity. And currently we have about approximately $70 million of bonds outstanding. So we have a large amount of capacity available. And also, depending on the type of a bond, if we did it as a revenue bond, then that would not affect our general capacity. So it would depend on the project whether or not we would want to use our general bonding capacity or whether or not it would be a revenue bond. But certainly we have the capacity to issue up to $200 million of bonds for these type of facilities. Again, I'd like to say that just because we have this bonding authority, it does not mean that we would utilize all the authority or that, again, as you've said, Representative Sandler, we would be looking at our capacity as we go through with each and every project that would be under this bond authorization to ensure we have the capacity and that it wouldn't affect the ability to fund other projects. And we go through that type of capacity analysis with every project that we would look at to bond or utilize bond financing with.
Paul? Thank you. Good answer, Ted. And one last question following up on the speaker's question. The other question is, how much is Brooks Range looking to borrow from you? Have they given you any idea of the capacity, how much money they would need for their processing facility? Ted?
Scared him off.
He hung up on me. Okay.
Well, if you'd hear us, thanks a lot, Ted. I don't see any further questions for Ted other than the one that's hanging out there. But with that, I might add that we've got Errol Champion representing the Board of Realtors who's in the room and has been here for most of these meetings for questions if we have any impacting the Realtors Association. And with that, public testimony is still open. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Seeing none. With that, we will close out public testimony on 2:30. Any further questions for the sponsor's representative? We will hold this meeting over, and I imagine it will be moving shortly. We'll set it aside temporarily. And with that, brief at ease. We're back on the record, and the next item on the calendar is House Bill 316. Carrying the bill is Anna Latham from my my office. We heard House Bill 316 on March 7th and March 10th. During the meeting on March 10th, the committee adopted a CS version O and took some public testimony. Today it's my intention to close out public testimony and hold the bill over for Wednesday so members can have an opportunity to review two amendments that were distributed today. Anna, can you give us a real quick summary? I think everybody that's listening is probably familiar with it, but on the off chance we have somebody that hasn't
For the record, my name is Anna Latham, staff to Representative Olson. And House Bill 316 changes the fee schedules for workers' compensation from a UCR schedule, which the state has used for the past 10 years, to a resource-based relative value scale based on CMS, or Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services rates, with a conversion factor that's set by the Workers' Comp Board under the advisement of the Medical Services Review Committee.
That works for me. Any questions for Anna before we continue the public testimony?
I'll try a couple.
Sure.
Thank you. Ms. Latham, if the bill passes, what do you perceive the medical fees target to be? In other words, if you take what exists today, which is, I know there's some 90% number that's bandied about in terms of the UCR schedule that's supposed to reflect, well, what is your understanding of the 90% number?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, the target would be for fees to be set at a reasonable and fair amount so that the medical community could make a fair profit, but you would see, just in a roundabout way, you would see fees aligned with those of group health, so not see specific procedures inflated at the 400 to 800 percentile. That would be a target for this.
And Representative Joseph, in your packet, you'll find a comparison of the top 25 workers' comp procedures in comparison to Washington and three or four other states also with Medicaid. And so there is no easy answer on what it'll be other than what Ms. Latham just described. But you'll find we're over 1,000% on some procedures, which...
Well, if I could just take one more step.
Certainly.
A gentleman testified, I think it was related to this bill, but it may have been another bill that on health care that we looked at last week. And his name was Mr. Soyan of Premier Blue Cross. So it was not this bill.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that was House Bill 203.
Right.
That's an entirely different bill.
I understand. Mr. Soyan said that specialty services for some things like musculoskeletal care, cardiovascular, are 600 to 700% the Medicare rate in Anchorage. And he was looking at sort of, I think, any sort of general service, not a workers' comp patient. Would this bill, how can workers' comp patients get covered in those specialties unless there's sufficient compensation to match those sorts of rates? Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Okay. Representative Josephson, through the chair, the intent is to align these somewhere around group health rates. Mm-hmm. So if that's the rate that's being paid in Anchorage for group health, then that would probably be a comparison rate for workers' compensation. Okay. So, but the intent of this is just to get those rates that are extremely inflated to a reasonable rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions for Anna? Seeing none, why don't you stay there in case we need you? But with that, we'll reopen public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? And I might have, we've got Mike Montegal from the Department of Labor Division of Workers' Comp in the room for questions only, but for the committee's edification. And seeing nobody in the room, we do have Dick Traney in Anchorage from the Workers' Compensation Board. Are you with us, Dick?
Rick. Different.
Rick Traney? Brief it is. Hey, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And we were having some technical problems on this end, but I'm glad you got through.
Excellent. My name is Rick Traney, and I work for Teamsters Local 959 as the negotiation coordinator. And I am also serving my second term as a member of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board, representing industry. I'm sorry, representing labor. There we go. But haven't testified before, so a little nervous. You'll have to forgive me. Mr. Chairman and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, I'd like to add my support to House Bill 316. What you see in front of you is a product obviously brought forth by Representative Olson on request of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board members. We approved a resolution unanimously in December asking for this sort of authority, and how it came about was a result of what we call a listening tour. There was a special committee appointed with members from labor and members from industry that toured the state in listening sessions, and we had sessions in Anchorage, in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Kenai. And what we've heard and what we've seen over the years is a tremendous escalation in medical costs, which obviously has a factor in premiums paid by employers, and therefore other benefits that are available to employees are reduced when there is inflated spending on medical bills for employee injuries. And what the goal here is, what we're trying to do is have the board have the authority to set the medical fee schedule based on this statute. And what we're looking for is to have it more reflective of what the top insurers in the state of Alaska pay for the same procedures. What occurs now is that we are at the top of the nation and the top in the state for reimbursement for medical fees and services. And what we're looking to do is just bring that in line. And I believe there was a question earlier from Representative Josephson. Each type of specialty or service will have a different conversion rate. So it's really set up to be responsive after hearing, the Medical Services Committee, after hearing input from the medical providers themselves, and from insurers and from other participants in the system, is to set these rates in each group and medical services group to be more reflective of what you know, Joe Public pays when he goes to the doctor, or any other insured member or employee of the state goes when to the doctor, what they pay. And I believe the Workers' Compensation Board will be a lot more responsive to, of course, changing environments and changing fees. What we have now is a medical fee schedule that I believe we're in our second or third year of this, and before that, the medical fee schedule had been in place for 10 years with two price of living adjustments. So what we're looking to do is to have it be more responsive, and after public testimony, input from the doctors, medical community, medical providers, is to set these conversion rates at a modifier that's acceptable to them and to the public and to the employees and employers of the state of Alaska that use the workers' compensation system.
Rick, I've been to a few of your meetings, and you guys have a tough job in several different directions, but I appreciate you calling in today. Any questions for Mr. Craney?
Yes, I have one.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Craney, the target, I guess, of the bill is called the RVRVS, the Resource-Based Relative Value Scale. Do you know whether that links itself to or aligns itself with reasonable and fair amounts akin to group health?
I don't know the answer to that. The target isn't is not to have that be where we arrive. That's the basis for which we start before there's the conversion rates, or if you will, multipliers applied to the medical, you know, to the services contained in that. So that the end goal isn't to have it be those numbers. The goal is to use those numbers and then try to tailor it, you know, from the input and of the community and all the participants, consumers, if you will, to then arrive at a number.
Follow-up?
No.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Craney, I don't know if you're the best person to answer this, but in your information, do other states face similar kinds of dramatic cost disparities? My question was going to be if this is a fix that other states are doing, but frankly, the first question should be, is it a problem in other states?
You know, I can't speak to that a little bit. A more expert opinion would likely be rendered by Director Monagle, but, you know, in leading up to this, and we've heard, you know, we prepared for, you know, a sort of change like this for a couple years since we put in the last medical fee schedule. Other states have faced similar things. Historically, Alaska, you know, is now ranked number one in workers' compensation costs. And we were not always ranked that. I think as most recently as 2004, we were probably in the middle or lower one-third of costs. And so, as we haven't enacted any sort of cost reforms to stay relative to what private insurers pay for people that are their employees are covered, where we've arrived is we've arrived at this schematic where we've gone from, and Director Monagle would have more information, I think, you know, in the 20s and to number 50. And so other states have addressed this sort of thing, and I believe there might be, and you'd have to correct me, there might be 14, 15, 16 states that have some sort of medical fee schedule based on a derivative of this. It does seem to be a trend. It's just a way to try to make sure that if, you know, you go to the doctor for, you know, and you're privately insured, and I go to the doctor and I have workers' comp, that we're being charged the same thing.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again, Mr. Craney. Anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Anybody online?
Thank you.
With that, we'll close out public testimony on 316, and I'd like to bring up Mike Monagle for a couple of questions. Thanks, Adam.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Representative Josephson.
Well, one question for Mr. Monagle.
Mr. Trainey talked about a workers' comp cost being the first. That's just regular, sort of the regular fee schedule, but that's not things like the permanent partial impairment, where we're 36th out of 50. Am I right? I mean, it's true that we're number one in this one, albeit very important, category.
Now, through the chair, Representative Josephson, we're number one, but the number one in premium comes from a combination of things. It's made up of indemnity costs, which, as you referred to, permanent partial impairment is part of that, and medical costs are the other part of that. The medical portion in Alaska is about 75 cents on every dollar. Nationally, that's about 55 cents. The medical costs on a time loss claim, on an indemnity claim where you miss time away from work, the average medical cost for Alaska is about $57,000. Nationally, it's about $24,000. So our medical component of what makes up premium loss cost is significantly higher than the rest of the country. Other portions that you referred to, indemnity benefits, actually are about middle pack. PPI is a portion of indemnity, and you're correct. I think our PPI benefits are about the lower third of the country.
Okay. Paul? Yes, I can't see in the bill where this goal of linking ourselves to something akin to group health is shown. Is it your understanding of the bill that's a goal, or is it just something that the Medical Services Review Board in combination with workers' comp could be expected to do?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think for the most part, when we look at medical costs, if you look at something, for example, your general practitioner, what evaluation and management is the category of medical services, that would be your general office visit. I think that pretty much is in line with general health. It's really, as you alluded to, the specialty medicine, the specialty practitioners, perhaps some of the cardiologists, some of the orthopedics, where we see those rates that are significantly higher in Alaska than other states. And I think Member Trainey had mentioned in his testimony, when we sit down and we start developing conversion factors, we'd be looking at where costs are for each of these specialties. So evaluation and management would be looked at. It would come up with a conversion factor for that. We may have a separate conversion factor for surgery, a separate conversion factor for specialty surgery. And that's how I would think, through the Medical Services Review Committee and the board, we would be looking at adopting conversion factors. I don't think there's anybody's intent to come up with conversion factors that are going to dissuade a provider from treating an injured worker in this state. And I think through that collaboration between our medical trading partners and industry and labor, that we'd be able to arrive at a conversion factor that everyone can agree to.
Okay. I was going to ask another question, but Mr. Monaco covered it. Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Okay, got a couple different questions. I mean, there's a lot of costs that are high. There's labor costs are high. Producing oil is high. Education is high. And it's sad that, you know, we're very, very high at workers' comp as well. But, and I'm very interested in getting these costs down. So what I want to find out from you, first of all, the safety prevention in the workplace, those programs have been implemented, I would assume. And then I see of your 18 board, it looks like you're the chair, there was three pages of suggestions that you brought forth. Are you pleased with how much got incorporated into this bill, or do you still have issues?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, take your last question first. Since medical costs, in my opinion, are the elephant in the room, it's really the cost driver. If we can deal with that, I'd be pleased. I think that would help lower premium costs in the long term. Are there other issues with workers' comp that need to be resolved? Definitely. And the list of resolutions, I think, addresses some of those things. Some of them are related to medical, such as a recommendation for treatment guidelines to address utilization. But there's other things like reemployment benefits, legal costs. I mean, there are other things in the workers' comp system that we could address that would help lower costs, but certainly medical is the big issue. And as far, I'm sorry, your first question?
Well, I was, through the chair, I was just talking about making sure that there's, you know, safety and prevention and all that stuff is being implemented, because that's would be, you know, yes, number one to prevent the injury in the first place.
Yeah, I believe that the employers in Alaska overall do a great job at focusing on safety. From about 1990 to date, employment in Alaska has gone up over 100,000 jobs. During that same period in time, our loss rates, the number of workplace injuries, has gone from over 30,000 to less than 20. So we're growing employment and we're reducing injuries, and I think to a large degree that's because employers very much value safety programs and are very safety conscious. Our sister agency at Department of Labor, Labor Standards and Safety, has a safety consultant program where you can, on a confidential basis, consult with those safety specialists who will come out to the workplace. And I say it's confidential because they're not going to rat you out and give you a violation, but they're going to help you spot things that will create a safer work environment. And in consultation with the employer, help them put safety practices in place that will reduce that. A number of insurance companies also have premium reductions for workplace safety programs. It's not mandatory, but a number of insurance companies do provide that, including things like drug-free workplace. So there's incentive through insurance companies to have safe work environments as well through reduced premiums and premium discounts.
And if I could expand on that, there are a number of unions, and I'm not going to name them, that have also been actively involved in developing their own safety standards that have been picked up and utilized by both insurance companies and by self-insurers. So there are a number of people that are going in that direction, and we do have a good track record. Our severity is down significantly. Part of our problem is our aging workforce, and when you get hurt at, or injured at a older age, it takes time, more time and more expense to get put back together.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can answer Representative Sadler's question about whether or not this is an issue in other states, it certainly is. Prior to 1990, the majority of costs in workers' comp systems nationwide was indemnity costs, and we all focused on that aspect of loss costs. Starting about then, medical started surpassing indemnity as the big cost driver, and it's countrywide, it's not just Alaska. In 1990, there were 12 states that had fee schedules. Today, there are 6 states that do not have fee schedules. So there's been a big transition countrywide as people take on fee schedules. Not all of them are RVRVS fee schedules, but over 32 states now do have RVRVS type methodology in producing fee schedules. So it is an issue countrywide, and a number of states have been addressing this through various practices. Fee schedules has become a big tool in the toolbox to help control medical costs and workers' comp.
And not surprisingly, all 32 of those states have lower rates than we do.
Mr. Chairman, being number one, I think they all have lower rates than we do.
Any further questions for Mr. Monaco? Thanks again. And there's nobody online, nobody in the room. I closed out already. I didn't, did I?
Yes,
I did.
Yep. After Rick's training.
With that, I believe we're going to hold the bill over until the committee has time to review the amendments that are out, new amendments. And brief the bees. We're back up on the record. The next item before the committee is House Bill 60. Members have a blank CS in their packets. Can I have a motion to adopt the CS as the working document, version N?
Chair Olson, I move the committee to adopt committee substitute House Bill 60-28LS-0265-C as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And with that, we have the sponsor, Representative Grunberg, and his staff, Nikolai Bailey, to present the bill. Welcome, Ms. Bailey. I think it's the first time, your first time before our committee, isn't it?
It is, and I'm hoping that my representative will do most of the talking.
Unlike
we hope you will.
Thank you for joining us today, and Representative Grunberg, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back, and thank you folks for hearing the bill. I'm Max Grunberg, representing House District 14, which is the Boniface Russian Chap, part of Anchorage. And the legislative assistant who's helping me on this is Nikolai Bailey, and I appreciate her help on this. This bill actually is a combination of two bills. The first was House Bill 60, which was the Uniform Transfer on Death Act, and the second was House Bill 61, which repeals the prohibition against joint tenancy with the right of survivorship in real property. And we put them together because they both relate to the transfer of real property to speed it and make it easier and cheaper. I broke them out just for the ease of doing it in case one didn't make it, the other one could be considered separately. The Uniform Transfer, the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act is a very simple proposition, Mr. Chair. It simply allows a person to do what's called a TOD, Transfer on Death, deed that becomes effective upon one's death. You sign it now, record it, and it becomes effective on your death. You can revoke it. You can do another superseding deed. The person who is getting the property can disclaim the transfer of property. All you have to do is to make certain that that's recorded. In other words, if there's a wild deed that's not recorded, or there is a will that's not recorded, it does not affect the property. The purpose is to make it so it's very easy to determine who owns the property. We now have TOD bank accounts under federal and state law. Securities, personal property can be owned jointly, transfer on death. It avoids probate. It is taxed as a transfer on death. There's no present ownership. And that's basically it. It was brought to my attention when a retired attorney that some of you may know, Stan Ditas, who owns property in various states, said, you know, I've got property all over the place. I'd like to see if we could have this so I could prepare my estate now. And I looked into it. 21 other states have this, the latest being South Dakota. There are three other states in Alaska, four states or more considering it. It is the coming thing. I'm not aware of any opposition to it, except a couple of individual probate lawyers, one of whom is retired now, didn't like the fact that lawyers didn't have to be involved in everything. And I'd be the first to admit that in complex estates, probably lawyers should be involved. But for the simple cases, most people, where they just own a house and maybe a lot up in Big Lake or whatever, and a pension, this is a simple way of doing it, and it avoids probate, it avoids legal fees and that sort of thing. That is most of the bill, except for the repealer, which is back in Section 5. And by the way, we even have forms that can be used here. They don't have to be, but they're simple forms so that you can just do it if you wish. Use them if you wish. The exact Uniform Act, except for one provision here that deals with it's on page 2, lines 27 through 30, that we added an inter vivos deed. That means a deed that's given during the lifetime, that doesn't expressly revoke a transfer on death deed or part transfer on the part, creates a rebuttable presumption that the other deed is effective to revoke a previously recorded transfer on death deed or part thereof if the deed meets certain requirements here, that it completely divests the transferor of the transferor's interest. And that one standalone provision was suggested by a witness who testified before the District of Columbia City Council, which is their legislature, and suggested something like this. And it seemed to me a good idea, and we made it a rebuttable presumption because it might be that it wouldn't apply in a given case. I've talked with the commissioners, their staff, and they don't have any objection to that. The other provision dealing with that's not the Uniform Act is the repealer, which is in Section 5. And right now, we have an old statute from territorial days that says you cannot hold real property jointly with the right of survivorship. It has to be by tenants in common. The difference between a tenancy in common and joint tenancy with the right of survivorship is you both, in both cases, you have a present ownership in the property. It's not like a TOD deed where you don't get the ownership until you die. You have a present ownership, but with a tenancy in common, if you die, your estate gets your interest. If it's a joint tenancy with the right of survivorship, the other co-owners get it. And so you don't have to do a deed, I mean a will or something, to get it over to them. It is simpler. And it used to be there were things called the four unities, which is an old legal term that we really don't use much anymore. And that's why they didn't have allowed joint tenancy with the right of survivorship. The courts now look to people's intent, and so most states have gotten away from these old statutes that say you can't have joint tenancy in real property. And this just goes with the normal law in most states, and it'll simply put it under the common law where there are rules that the courts follow, and it's like most real property. We're not a code state. We follow the common law, and this just puts it back in the common law. And with that, I'd be delighted to take any questions. And again, thank you for hearing the bill.
Representative Josephson, no questions?
Yeah.
You remind me too much of law school. Just not going.
We're getting off light. Representative Sadler.
Can't have that. Representative Rubin, could you, on page 2, in lines 27 to 30, you said the only section that differs from the universal uniform bill. Could you kind of walk me through the process of there? An heir vivos deed would supersede a transfer on death?
It's kind of walk me through. Yeah. As in many of these uniform acts, they're drafted by a committee of commissioners on uniform state law, and they have one professor, in this case a professor from the University of Iowa Law School, who's the reporter. By the way, we have a member of the staff who was involved in this, who's on the phone and can testify about all of this, Ben Orzicki. This particular hypothetical apparently was overlooked when they drafted it. Mm-hmm. What this provision means, through the chair, Representative Sadler, is if you have a second deed,
indeed,
and it doesn't revoke the original deed, normally it would contain a revocation clause. There's what's called a rebuttable presumption, which means that it is presumed that the earlier deed, TOD deed, is revoked. If the new deed completely divests the grantor of his interest in the real property, and it also must satisfy A2, which means it's acknowledged by the transferor after after the acknowledgement of the deed being revoked and recorded before the transferor's death in the recording district where the deed's recorded. It's got to be both signed in front of a notary and recorded. And then it is, there can be a rebutting, but normally if you give one deed to a property and record it, and then you have another deed to the same property, and they're both, they both say TOD deed, or it's clear that, and they wouldn't, the second one wouldn't have to, but it would be generally pretty clear that your intent is to follow the later deed. But there may be a circumstance where that doesn't occur. And therefore, the rule in District of Columbia is it's absolute. And I didn't want to make this absolute, because one thing I've learned is there's always going to be some factual situation you didn't anticipate. So it's rebuttable. And that's what it's just to cover that unusual circumstance.
I think we can. You should never, ever, ever be absolute. I understand that.
I absolutely agree with you.
I could argue with you.
I'm glad we had this interchange, because as far as I know, we're the first and only state so far to adopt this. It does not destroy uniformity. Maybe the commissioners will pick it up later if they think it's a good idea, but certainly we now have this legislative history.
Any further questions for the sponsor, Representative Reinbold?
Your name is Max the Amender. How many times have you amended your own bill?
Countless.
The chair, can I offer a suggestion that if you want to amend it again in this committee, I would like the first opportunity to put forth the amendment.
If you're on the committee?
Your bill stays in this committee.
Because if you pass it out, we're going to look at some things in the next committee that don't necessarily have to do with what we're doing. But I'd be happy to work with you, but it's on judiciary.
Judiciary, so you'll, okay, so.
But we're not going to do anything more. Yeah, this is the way it's going to go.
Is that committee. What you need?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Any further questions for the sponsor? With that, we are going to begin taking testimony from outside the building from a gentleman that's calling in from Chicago. So I think he's, because of the time difference, is at the top of the list. Benjamin Orzeski, Uniform Law Commission. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
And I apologize for probably butchering your last name, but could you read yourself onto the record, please?
Yes, my name is Benjamin Orzeski, and I'm a legal counsel with the Uniform Law Commission in Chicago for Real Property Trust and Estate Acts.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg did a very good job of describing this bill. I don't want to repeat the testimony, but I would be happy to take any questions from any of the committee members who would like perhaps more detail on the act.
That's perfect. Representative Josephson? Well, you got off real light. Thank you, Representative Reinbold. Nope.
I was asking if you had a beaver.
For the record, Mr. Chair, his written testimony is in the
packet. Oh, and we do have his written testimony in the packet. And, thanks again for joining us today. Deborah Randall from Anchorage. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Deborah Randall. I'm here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm an estate planning attorney. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I was absolutely delighted when I first got introduced to this uniform bill probably over a year ago. The uniform bill was presented to the estate and probate section, and I am a total believer in this for the very reason that I believe it will simplify matters for so many of my clients who only have a piece of property. And are you still there?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, I just didn't know if my phone was working. A standard client will have, real estate, which is their house, and they'll have bank accounts that, as Max Gruenberg explained, can be passed by operation of law, either through a joint account or with a beneficiary designation. And so the only property they have that they can't do that with is with real property. And this act will simplify that for countless people. And I am a firm believer in the proposition of keep it simple, because it just makes it so much easier for people to do. And as a lawyer, I'm not worried it's going to affect my workload at all, because there's always the old adage that says, you know, buyer beware. You better make sure you know what you're doing. So I think a lot of people will still use lawyers for advice, but this will just be one more quiver in our arsenal that we can use. And I'm also totally in favor of revoking the joint tenancy, the prohibition on joint tenancy by survivorship with real property. I mean, every state does that. Our favorite states, you know, those sunshine states, Arizona, Hawaii, they allow joint tenancy by survivorship, which works great if you have a surviving child or children that you want to leave the property to. So it will definitely simplify estate planning for a lot of people and give them more alternatives, which I think is a win-win for everyone.
Any questions? Representative Gruenberg, you have a question for yourself?
It's just a statement to point out something. Ms. Randall was very involved in the work on this that the probate and real estate sections did on the bill. And I just wanted to point out something to the committee that I had neglected to mention, that because of the concern that some people had that, you know, people not get in over their heads without a lawyer, we put in language on page 5 in the optional form that carefully advises them that this may have important legal consequences and what some of them are, and if you have any questions, consult an attorney, and that is in bold. And if I could ask Ms. Randall one question, please.
One.
That was the subject of considerable discussion, was it not?
Oh, the main consideration was that, you know, people would be doing these transfers without really understanding what they were doing, and lawyers were concerned about that. So I definitely, that was one of the things we talked about in our committee, was adding this kind of language, which is great, because it will make people, put them on notice that maybe there are more issues here than just transfer of real property, for example, creditor claims, you know, children that have disabilities, those kinds of things. So hopefully that warning will make them stop and think before they act.
Representative Herron, did you have a question for the sponsor or Ms. Randall?
No, for the sponsor is fine.
Thanks again, Ms. Randall.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg. So just so we have it on the record, was there like a powerful lobby way back when in territory days, joint tenancy lobby, where they did it to, it wasn't to protect people, or what was the nexus? What was the connection? Why this prohibition ended up in territorials and carried over to statehood?
First of all, through the chair, to answer your question, Representative Herron, I have not been able to do extensive research, but there is one case on the subject. The name of the case is Carver versus Gilbert, an old case from 1963. And it talks about the genesis of this particular statute that's being repealed. It was taken from the laws of Oregon. When they did the Organic Act in the late 19th century, early 20th century, many of the statutes throughout the code were taken from the laws of the state of Oregon. And this was one of them. And back in those days, the four unities were big, and there was the unity of time, title, I think possession and interest. And everything was much more formal than it is today. They didn't look so much at the intention of the parties, like how you could get out from under the joint tenancy and revoke it. I assume that this was part of their thinking, but it came from the laws of Oregon, and it's pretty hard for us in many cases, I've researched other statutes, they go back and the Organics Act section such and such, this was taken from Oregon, and you can look at the Oregon laws in the 1890s, and you may or may not be able to find it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Follow? No. Any further questions for the sponsor? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. First, Representative Goodman, do you have any idea, any estimate, how much property is transferred under transfer on death provisions in other states? In other words, how much market share is being taken away from probate courts by transfer on death provisions?
I think we should probably ask Ben that. He may know. I don't know.
If he's still online?
Still online?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, did you hear the question?
Yes, about how much these are being used in other states.
Yeah, could you read yourself onto the record again, please?
Yes, this is Benjamin Orzeski. I'm with the Uniform Law Commission in Chicago. We don't have hard statistics on that. I know that the first state that allowed these was Missouri in 1989, and the second state didn't allow it until about 8 years after that. So Missouri has by far the longest history on these. Even there, it's still a relatively small percentage of transfers. Again, I don't want to pretend I have statistics that I don't have, but I would be my estimate would be somewhere in the range of 5 to 15% of transfers would use this method.
Okay. And a follow-up for the sponsor, actually. This is, I'm going to use a good word, is this extra testamentarial? Is this outside of will? You have to have a will to have this kind of odds? Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I respond? No, it's definitely, you don't do it with a will. Mm-hmm. And that, if you do it with a will, it goes through probate generally.
Sure.
And that's the purpose. And you do it much before, you can do it 20 years before you're even ready to do the will. Or you can just do it, it can just be a few weeks before you die. But it's definitely not part of the will. You could reference it if you want.
Never died before, so I've never experienced all these provisions. So,
and we've got a couple more people that are signed up to testify. Ken Hellander, are you with us? Anchorage?
I am here, yes.
Oh, thank you. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Hellander. I'm the Associate State Director for Advocacy representing AARP's Alaska's 90,000 members. We are pleased to offer our support for the passage of the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act, including the repeal of the prohibition of joint tenancy with right of survivorship. Probate laws, which govern the transfer of property at death, vary significantly from state to state. The variations in and complexity of such laws contribute to misunderstanding of this process, which led to the development of uniform model legislation to simplify and clarify the process for the average consumer. Non-probate transfers such as payment on death accounts, accounts passing by beneficiary designation, and joint accounts passing by right of survivorship do not involve the court system and thus give people a way to transfer control of personal assets without the costs and other unwanted side effects of probate litigation. This bill, House Bill 60, would authorize transfer on death deeds to enable revocable non-probate real property transfers. Many older people have fixed or limited incomes, and very often their principal asset is their home. At time of death, survivors having to go through complex, costly, and lengthy probate procedures to settle a simple matter is an unnecessary burden at a time of bereavement that is complete with its own stress. Transfers on death, besides being simple and inexpensive, also protect the property interests of the owner by avoiding many of the pitfalls that occur with deeds in common, which can even lead to financial exploitation of a vulnerable elder. We believe the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act will serve the best interests of Alaskans, and we encourage passage. Thank you for the opportunity to offer our support.
Well, thank you for joining us today. And in the room, welcome back, Marie. Marie Darlin. A very familiar face. been a while, Marie. I think we missed you last year.
I was here.
No.
You just weren't working?
Not testifying.
You just weren't working on our bill.
But please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm the chair of the Legislative Advocacy Committee here in Juneau. And I am here to, if I wanted, just repeat a lot of what Ken Helander just told you and everybody else here, too. But mainly to say that we do support this and, you know, encourage you to finalize it out this year now. It started last year and I think has been, you know, has had some good work done on it, and we do definitely want to support it. And it's our membership who actually are the ones that get involved in some of these kinds of issues more than maybe others. And so therefore we are concerned about issues like this that do help them when there are these kinds of things they have to contend with. And so with that, we just say we support it.
Well, again, welcome back, Marie.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? I think he's questions only. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought he was questions only. Carol, you doubt this question only. That was Max's fault, not mine.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here to answer questions again. We were on record last year. My name is Errol Champion, and I'm chair of Alaska Association of Realtors Issues Committee and also a director with Alaska Association. We wrote a letter in support of HB 60 a year ago. We continue to be in support of it. The hour's late. All I encourage you is it's a right move, because the most important asset most families have is their home. This allows the right of passage without having to go through a lot of legal costs. And often it creates additional costs because of the length of time to go through probate. So we urge the adoption of HB 60.
Thanks again, Errol. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Thanks for being here in person, Earl. I talked to some of the realtors in Eagle River about this, and they expressed support for it, but it wasn't on the record, so I appreciate you putting the association's stamp of approval on the bill in public on the record. Thank you.
Yeah. It's amazing how many, Representative Sadler through the chair, it's amazing how many real estate transactions in the state are the passage of ownership because of a death.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bigger number than most of us realize.
Yeah.
And again, thank you for joining us today. And with that, we will hold the public testimony open and set the bill aside. And with that, we're adjourned at 4:40.